that never blows my it never ceases to blow my mind that you can get on a train at your local train station and in like 5 hours or so you can get off in Paris, and obviously that's like pretty cool. So
like the most amazing thing in the UK is leaving it.
Welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams. Hello and welcome to Single Track Mind, the rail enthusiast podcast. We're talking long distance European train journeys this week. Obviously, we had a whole season on the one fucking train line in Australia, so we know we are testing our listeners' patience a little bit. So we're going to talk about a continent that has good rail links for a change. But first of all, I want to find out how my co-hosts are doing. Fellas, you've just been at a big train conference, the biggest train conference in the world, in Austin.
Is it? No, I don't know if it was this year. maybe not this year, maybe other years.
But consensus is the biggest.
Okay,
blockchain conference, right? Bigger than ETH Denver, surely.
Oh, definitely
not this year. Really?
You're right. That's a fair point. Like,
okay. Well, it's tough to tell because like, has started it early and spicily. Okay,
it's tough to tell because Denver's so spread out. I guess they both have a shitload of side events. It always seems like consensus has more side events, and so maybe there's like just people spread out more. The show floor is bigger. Actually, I don't even know. Right? ETH Denver's show floor might have been bigger this year.
I think it is. And God, there are a couple events we went to and there were like six people there and the teams were just like 12 team people, six not team people. And so everyone was standing around awkwardly like,
Hey.
It's a real bear market energy. I thought we're in a bull again.
It was weird. I think the show floor had a decent amount of people, but it wasn't packed. And then Schulze's right. Like we went to a few events. We went to one event that we thought we were in the wrong event. Right.
Yeah.
And then some dude waved us over. He's like, you guys look like you're looking for me. We're like, I guess so. Yeah. And then that actually was a great event. I won't say who it was. It's because it wasn't embarrassing because it was like a last minute thing. It was no big deal. But it was like a last minute thing. And then we knew about it. And then we went to this thing.
It was
a Leo. So we went to an Leo thing. And literally it was just, I forget, it was Brendan, right? Who's a DevRel lead?
No, Brendan, I think Brendan. He was like head of media or something. Marketing.
That's right. He's on the marketing side. And he's like, yeah, we grabbed some appetizers and some beers. And it was really nice because Alex, CEO, was there. And like, we had a really nice conversation. It was actually one of the best conversations we had just because there wasn't 1,000 people, right? And you just had a chance to sit down and we were able to joke about like just Aleo things, you know, like the, like the validator vote on whether mainnet's ready and all this kind of stuff. And we were able to have like really good conversations about that where and the environment might be awkward. But we just literally sitting around having beers and like eating nachos and shit, which was really, really nice. It was also very unconsensus, like I think was different.
I mean, that sounds good.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Same thing at Bear Chain. We went to a Bear Chain event one of those nights. I remember it was early in the week though, so that might have been it too. But like they were expecting like 700 people and there was maybe a couple hundred, maybe like 150 or something like that. Which was also nice because we had a chance to meet everybody and like there's a bunch of people there, which was cool. Like there's nothing wrong with that. Like I think it's fine. It doesn't really say anything, but everything was a lot more approachable this year than I thought it was in 2022.
I've been describing it as intimate. Like at the ETH Denver, you really couldn't interact with the teams. Like you'd go there to actually talk to a specific team or person. Right. And I think I only achieved that like three times because there's just so many people that me with being introverted, like, I don't want to go butt into a conversation and be like, hey, this is my name and this is what I do. Because they're going to be like, well, I'm busy, don't care. So I don't want to deal with it. But at consensus, because there was downtime, I don't want to say downtime, it's not quite the way to put it. There was less stress to like meet everyone and talk to everything. Right. People were willing to just kind of like pull you into the conversation. And you didn't have to have that additional mental overhead of like, how am I going to actually like make this work? It was just everyone was open to talking with people.
Yeah. Yeah, it was cool. And there's a lot of really good, I mean, there's a lot of really good people there, which you would expect. And there was a lot of surprising like Cosmos people there. Cause we knew Berlin was going, was it Berlin? Is that where it was?
Yeah.
So. Yeah. So Berlin was going at the same time. So there was like, everybody's like, oh, there's not too many Cosmos events. But I mean, we saw a ton of, Ethan was there and Jack was there and
Cosmos
Jay from Say and like Shane was down there. And like, there was like, a lot of folks that we would typically see at a pretty large Cosmos event were all there.
Yeah, but I mean, I think a lot of people in the Cosmos space that I want to say I do are more ambitious, maybe, are not going to Cosmos events if there is a substantially bigger event that's non-Cosmos specific.
Yeah, I don't know. Or maybe there were lessons, yeah. I or think. Maybe just like different, maybe just different goals, right? Yeah. Like they know all those, maybe they're trying to make different relationships. You know what I mean?
So would you say that the popularity of the conference is on the wane?
I wouldn't say that.
Would you say its appeal is becoming more selective?
Yeah, I would say it's more institutional. Like Fidelity was there. I saw a Vanguard person. You're smiling like there was a joke there, and I feel like I didn't pick up on the joke.
I just quite a spinal tap at you. It's fine. It's fine. I'm over it. I'm already over
you
it.
You did?
Yeah. I asked you whether the popularity of the event was on the wane, to which the response is no. I think their appeal is becoming more selective.
I see. Okay.
that's one of those films I think probably other than Master and Commander that we've seen the most. So anyway.
I mean, I usually know my Spinal Tap quotes. That one totally went over my head.
he's too busy thinking about the limo. But so, I mean, it sounds pretty good though. I think like my weird thing is that I've done like the Chainlink specific one, Barcelona last year.
Right.
And then I've done side events at fintech conferences that have been blockchain companies or foundations. And those are always weird. It's just like, who's the audience? Little bit. And then before that, it was just the you know, Cosmos at the height of when all the chains were launching, which was just insane. And then just after I did the Cosmos Gateway one, just after Terra exploded. That was like a week after.
When you say exploded, do you mean like it fell apart or isn't it got popular? That's an important distinction.
It fell apart. So like Cosmos Gateway was like 15th of May or something, 22. So like I think Terra had literally fallen apart like 14 days before. Like there were like the validators were stood around talking about like, hey, did you get wrecked? Like people were in the after event in a club in Prague being like, how much did you lose? So I don't know. I really do at some point want to go to an industry conference for this space, which isn't like either like frothing total mania or like funeral after party. And we'll ignore all the fintech stuff because those have just been like a whatever, man. Like, but yeah, it sounds relatively good. Why do you think it was like more intimate this year?
I think there's just less people. There's nothing more than that.
Yeah, but what? Why?
Like, why less people?
Yeah, but then 22. 22 was like full on bear at that point. Like,
yeah.
Everything was
I mean, forward. Yeah, Bitcoin's at $70,000. I don't know. I mean, there's still a Lambo with like Shinu Inu fucking dogs plastered over it in the front. So like, there's some of that shit is still there, right? There's people walking around
with cyber trucks with ads on them.
There's a lot of cyber trucks with ads on. There's people walking around with the huge plastic gold chains. Like, so there's a few of that still happening, but it wasn't as like crazy. And Schulze's right. There's a lot more suits, which is bullish.
Yeah.
There were a couple of events that I went to where I think I stood out as the youngest by like 20 years. And I was like, okay.
I need to go to those. That's my crew.
I mean, I have a thesis, right? I've been thinking about, so like, obviously I've been having a few, I've been trying to work out like some new business stuff. I've been also like doing some stuff where networking, maybe it's networking, but I'm not, as you guys know, not super hooked in with what is going on in TradFi, right? But I now have like the tiniest crack, a window into it as it reflects on what we do, right? Yeah. That I have acquired over the last 7 or 8 months or whatever. And I really do think there's like this, like, so I always go on about like Ethereum boomers and Bitcoin boomers, like, because the tech is just not there, but everybody's just grandfathered, like, you know, it's got market share. So people are just like building on top of it. It's just becoming this It's like, you know, one of those houses in Edinburgh in like the 17th century where they just collapsed eventually because before steel construction, you just couldn't build a building that high. Eventually they would fall apart. But people kept adding stories until they did. And that's kind of like Ethereum. But what seems to be happening now, at least from a complete outsider's perspective, is that that's where the TradFi, like for whatever reason, that's feels like that's becoming grandfathered in as, oh, well, it's just old and broken enough now that it can be mainstream.
Yeah.
Like because banks, well, everybody, they have to adopt broken old technology. That's how it works. You know, they've got to bake a COBOL mainframe and then run it for 15 years. And they're like, ah, Ethereum, this will do.
I think a big part of that is just because that's where all the DeFi is. Like technically the DeFi happens elsewhere, right? But Ethereum still holds something like 50% of all crypto funding, maybe even more than that. And so if there's anywhere they should try and get in, probably it's got to be Ethereum, right?
Like it genuinely is, but man, so I've had some conversations like in the last while where they've been like very casual, just like finding out what people are working on, trying to get a feel for like if research stuff that I'm working on dovetails with that. And also just like practically from a company perspective, if there's anything we do like consultancy or whatever that might tie in with that, like I'm all fucking ears. I can't remember the second half of that joke. Somebody with big ears. Anyway, and I feel like there's these situations, you know, when you have that voice, like when you're just having like a casual conversation, somebody says something and you're like, ah, I could give you an idea here and I don't know how much that idea is worth. And I know you won't pay me for this idea because you don't understand why it's a good idea. Like for me to explain to you why this would be a good idea and potentially very profitable to you, I can't execute on it because of the situation that I'm in. You could execute on it. It wouldn't even cost you that much. It could be worth a lot of money to your company. But in order for, like, I can't just give you the idea. Like, it's not that simple. Like, you'd also need to understand it, appreciate the opportunity, and then execute on it. But, like, you're like, there is no world in which I'm going to get paid for this idea. So should I just say it anyway? And I had one of those conversations a little while ago where I just punted the idea out there into open space and somebody else in the room was like, oh, like literally did the maths of like what they actually did get it. And then they were like, huh. And then the next time I met up with those people, they just casually were talking about that project, which is now like 2 months further along. And they're like, oh, and of course this part. And I was like, fuck, that's the bit I gave them. And I was like, oh, out of interest, why are you guys, what's the use case there? Because you're not doing, it was basically something to do with DAOs essentially. And they were like, and I was like, it doesn't seem like you're using that in the way that like, I think a lot of people would. And they were like, oh no, cause you know, you launch a token, right? And if that ends up being worth $1 billion, then we just made $1 billion for free. Right. And I was like, damn, they got both the completely degen case that I would have made and the sensible case I would have made. And they threw away the sensible case, kept the degen case. And if they make $1 billion, I gave away $1 billion idea for free. I can't believe this shit. But yeah, it was the only reason I kind of referenced that is because it was interesting to me how if you're in a position where you can execute on a risky idea and you're kind of covered from a regulation perspective, or you have a presence in the market where you know the regulator, you have the lawyers, you have the advice, you can just execute on anything that you think is within your risk tolerance. There's so much crazy shit you can do, and it's easiest to do on Ethereum, probably. Like back to your point, Shortsy. But the second half of that though, which was that this idea, like if somebody had to understand it or whatever, and like I look at situations like that where it's like you can build it on Ethereum or YOLO, it's a bit harder, but you could just fucking launch your own chain. Like that entire example, like the DGEN bit of it was like we get a way in which we can launch a token, and if it becomes worth something, then happy days, right? And you're like, when all of these banks realize that they can just start a blockchain, like they're going to jump on Cosmos or the SDK about 5 years too late. Because they'll be like, wait. I can just start this blockchain in like 5 minutes and I can just throw Cosmos on top of it. Or I can throw an EVM on top of it, even better, because Solidity is objectively better. We've lost that argument. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. There was a point in there somewhere. It's something like it's so easy to like if you can execute on a really quite degen idea and feel safe from a regulatory perspective, there's no reason why you can't execute on something slightly more degen if it's just like launching a chain rather than launching an ERC20, right? And when people work that out, they're like, we have a proliferation of blockchains now. Shit is going to get completely out of hand. That's my feeling. When you talk to people in suits, they haven't even realized the power and potential of their own degeneracy yet. That's, I think, my point.
Well, I think that that's going to get a leg up here soon with Eigenlayer and AVSs, because those are spinning up just like the Cosmos summer of, 2021. Like, I think there's 70 AVSs so far on Eigenlayer, and not to be too negative on stream, but like I'm pretty bearish on Eigenlayer right now, just because I don't expect that its returns are going to be able to pay back the amount of stake going into it. And it's just going to get worse. Like, there's just gonna be more and more AVSs, just like an ICS. And whenever institutions realize how easy it is to spin up an AVS and how many validators are just going to grab onto it because it's the next name. Oh man. Like it's ICS, but easier.
So, okay. Dumb question. Eigenlayer. What is technically that different from all the other DVT type solutions? Because that's what it is. It's like it's decentralized liquid staking on top of heterogeneous blockchains, right? Something like that.
I mean, it's using liquid staked Ethereum or Ethereum, native Ethereum, as its security protocol. So if you have like Lido staked ETH, you can stake it to Eigenlayer and then validate for it. So it doesn't have like a one-to-one of all Ethereum validators can secure a chain. Has to be actively restaked, but there's still a huge sum. It's still like day one, there was like $10 billion on Eigenlayer. And so basically it's creating like selective validator sets. I can't remember the AVS something is something validator set. I can't remember the A word. And so if you spin up an AVS, you
actively just validated services apparently.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go. Yeah. So I don't know how that's related to DVT.
I think probably I thought that the bit that is, I guess, covered by the Lido piece was actually part of the mechanism for Eigenlayer. But it sounds like actually their part is just the semantics of the validator sets.
Yeah. Now, Eigenlayer makes a little bit of a distinction from ICS in that in Eigenlayer, all validators can choose whether they want to support one or not. But from what we've seen so far, validators are just joining all of them because
it's going to be a shit show.
Yeah.
That's going to be a shit show. That's going to be a complete shit show.
Validators are joining all of them? What do you mean joining all of them? Meaning like running as many AVS as they can.
Exactly. It's like, yeah, how can I also join all of them?
Yeah.
Polkadot,
is there a dollar to be made? Yeah.
Polkadot runs every single one and does a snapshot for every single one already.
That's right. Damn straight.
The hardest working is intern in not only the Cosmos now, but the entire of the Eigenverse. I'm not sure if that's a word. Anyway, so we're bullish on Eigenlayer. We are, apparently breaking news from Rama. The hub has halted.
Yeah,
well, not that breaking news, but yeah.
And I'm feeling fine. Okay, cool. Right. If somebody wants to let us know how that pans out as the show continues, that would be great. So, other takeaways from consensus.
Tons of ZK. Everybody's talking about ZK.
Good.
Yeah.
Love it. Love to see it. As long as it's not a shitty roll up, so I love to see it.
That was a big topic. Staking, huge topic, right? I think overall, it was like a lot of talks about methods for Ethereum staking. It was a huge thing.
Yep.
What else? What else were big things, Schultzy?
Regulation.
Regulation.
The ETF was being podcast and catching up with us.
Yeah.
Yeah. A bit. Yeah. Well, yes. I think obviously with the Bitcoin and Ethereum piece, that was all new since last consensus. So there's a lot of discussion around what that means. And I think that's why we had a lot of talks with crypto experts at large institutions, which, okay, it's cool. It's good. What else? I'm trying to think what else were major themes. A lot of services chains. I thought, like, a lot of Oracle just conversations and a lot of DeepIn. Oh, and AI. How the fuck did we forget about AI?
Yeah.
Jesus. That was like every goddamn. Yeah. So AI's there a lot of, but actually a lot of, to be fair, a lot of different aspects of how a blockchain and AI work together. And there are some really cool implementations of the use of using blockchain as a payment method and a reward method for the use of models. And that's actually a really good use case, honestly. Versus like, hey, I buy an unlimited subscription to ChatGPT. But can all of us create models for specific things and have different ways to be able to identify which is the best model and have scoring structure and then have payment structure based on use and value coming from that?
That's Allura that's doing that, right?
Yes, Allura is one of those that are doing that. But Allura has the model structure related to the actual creation of those, allow ability to be able to create those models and then be able to have methods for determining based on history what models best predicted based on time of day or other types of things or geography or like a ton of different things. And those were all financial based, the ones that we saw. But that's a pretty cool way.
Facetiously, I mean, sounds good. The problem they're solving there is a marketplace, right? They're trying to create a marketplace for AI models. Why can they not do that with a marketplace that they've just built in a technology and
they can?
Yeah.
Okay. They can. I mean, you can make that case for like any, almost everything though, right?
Well, sure. So I guess the underlying assumption and question behind my facetious question is what is the special sauce that the smart contracts are bringing to the table in terms of the incentive mechanisms behind it? Like, is there something that's fundamentally like low, that works in a low trust environment or involves micropayments or does something well that blockchains do well versus, you know, cold hard cash?
I think it's the micropayments thing. So one of the reasons why I really like Akash theoretically is how it doesn't really need to be.
You theoretically like how I might theoretically like Akash.
Yeah. I really like how it doesn't need to be Web3, but instead it's really, my vision of it is like, it's an open source project that uses blockchain as its funding mechanism, right? Because open source historically has a really difficult time finding funding. There's a couple of methods, like you can go through Patreon to get funding. GitHub now has subscriptions similar to Patreon, and we subscribe to a couple of open source projects that we use, like Caddy. We go through Caddy for that. But the fact that Akash can use its own token to get micropayments, as you said, and kind of bypass like Visa fees and stuff, I think that's really cool. I think it's a really cool way to support open source. And right. I see that as being a big benefit to Allura, where let's say you ask one question, you have to pay, I don't know, 0.1 Allura or whatever. I'd kind of go for that. Kind of similar to like Kagi, where Kagi has like you buy credits for searching, for private searching. I like that idea. I think it's really cool.
But so the point here, I guess, is that the fundamental problem that's being solved is micropayments, right? And in order to solve it, a foundation is selling you a token. I mean, you might buy it over an exchange, a DEX or a SEX, doesn't really matter. But essentially, there's an intermediary who has minted that, which is the foundation or the developers or whatever. They have created intermediation in order to sell you the payment to then do the thing. Like that is really, really interesting, because like one of the main things we're supposed to be doing here with blockchains is disintermediation, right? Which is splitting, like taking away B2B and being like B2C or C2C. Type interactions. Like everything is a marketplace, everything is incentives, smart contracts will do the rest, right?
That's business to consumer and consumer to consumer.
Yes, sorry, yes. So like basically removing middleman, if you like, right? Disintermediation, removing middleman. But what we're actually kind of doing is going, well, there's actually, we're adding a different middleman with potentially a lower or different cost basis or cost structure, right? The Akash system the cost structure is different from AWS. It isn't necessarily cheaper, and you also need to have AKT, which conveniently will also make money for the ecosystem of people that depend on that, the validators, the developers, the whatever, who are all middlemen, actually. And as validators, we are part of the intermediation of these services. So I guess it's just like a continuing thing that I guess I find pretty interesting as like one of the founding use cases and the things that both academics and people who are kind of theoretically or ideologically minded in the blockchain space do talk a lot about disintermediation. And actually, like, what we're doing is like, we're just shifting around the agents a lot of the time. Like, the thing that disintermediates is cash, right? Private money doesn't, because if you spend with a Visa card, right, Visa making bank on that, and usually the people you're buying from, the cool coffee shop you go to, Schulze, I'm guessing, it's probably quite a cool coffee shop, the vendor might be sucking up the payment charge, right? Because people expect to pay on the card, right? Mm-hmm. But by paying cash, I mean, obviously the government is an intermediary there because they are back in the cash, but Visa aren't in the loop there, are they?
I mean, that's an interesting point. So it's like, the question is it more beneficial as a team to have indirect intermediaries, which would be the validators and stuff, or direct? You can see you pay Visa 40 cents plus 3% for every transaction versus how much are validators selling tokens, drawing down the price.
Right. At which point you then eventually get to the point where you're like, well, hang on, you don't need a token at all. You just need something to drive a way of building an incentive system so that you as developers get paid, right? And you don't need a val set necessarily. That's also another assumption. Don't need a token. Don't need a chain, probably, because you don't need to worry about double spending if you haven't got a token. Don't need a val set. Don't need, blockchain undermines itself, I think, in a lot of these use cases, is the shower thought I've been having lately. I think you need smart contracts. Like, I think smart contracts is source. I think that's actually really nice source. I think the bit that's actually good, the blockchain's good for, is ensuring the smart contracts don't do weird double spendy shit. What's the word I'm looking for? The thing that takes ages when a Cosmos chain starts. What is that?
The validators?
The checks. What are they called?
Invariance checks.
Right. Yeah, exactly right. So invariance, system integrity checks. Like, the thing that blockchain's quite good for is that kind of stuff, right? There's the scaffolding you can put around like a smart contract VM. But all the token, all that other stuff, I don't know, man. Like, I think as long as a smart contract can deal with an external representation of value, which is purely in the hands of the programmer, man. Like,
anyway, AI was a huge theme.
Anyway, to bring it away,
I was liking this path. I thought that was a pretty hot take. That was pretty interesting.
I believe in disintermediation. I think it's a cool idea, and I think like
it's a cool idea.
One of the things that I've been working with people who are working on cash systems and who are very privacy conscious, I've started using cash more because I've been brainwashed. And in 2024, right, try and live a week using cash, right? That is my advice to you.
Brutal.
Yeah. No, seriously, this is a good experiment with how much financial intermediation is actually present in your life. Try and use cash for a few days. Like, I've tried to do this recently. You hit a brick wall very, very quickly. You start having to go and shop at different places, to buy your coffee at different places, to buy your lunch at different places. And I think the analogy kind of holds true for blockchains and all that sort of stuff, except that you literally hit the brick wall as soon as you try and move from one blockchain to another. And like, IBC is good for that, right? You can have, but it makes you realize like how insanely complex this can get if like essentially every blockchain is a walled garden, right? And I guess that's why the attraction of all these eigenlayer type things is that they just go, just use ETH. ETH is the US dollar of blockchains. It's like, no. ETH is a shit version of the US dollar. That you should use a stable coin before you use ETH, although you maybe shouldn't use a stable coin for other reasons. But I don't know. Whatever. Shower thoughts.
It's sad because I've been trying to get away from cash for so long. And I love not carrying cash. Like, that was like one of my favorite things of trying to get away from that. And then now for all that desire, I've created a world that, God damn it. You're right. They're like, there's so many intermediaries between those types of things.
There's a really interesting article actually in the Financial Times, I think it was this week, about how, so we talked on here before a few times about challenger banks and stuff like that. There's something that, I mean, it has happened in the States, obviously, but like there was a big springboard of a lot of it happening in the UK a few years ago. And a lot of it was driven by people who were kind of inspired by Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies to improve traditional banking and user experiences and get things on mobile. And What's happened now is all the big banks have caught up. And there's this really interesting conversation, and there's a great article in the FT about this week. I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact title, but if you look for it, you'll find it. It's about challenger banks, Monzo, Starling, Revolut, stuff like that. And they basically take some user usage numbers, and they hypothesize that a lot of people use these challenger banks to have a really good user experience, essentially as like cash clearing. But they actually keep their money and their like salary or whatever will go into a traditional, like what you call a high street bank, like a big bank. One of the ones that's come over to the UK recently that's apparently massively growing is Chase, right? Which is a high street bank for you guys. And what they kind of theorize that maybe, you know, these new challengers have actually done very, very well with getting people's hearts and minds, but not so well in them actually fully trusting them, you know, with their money. And what they say is that then, you know, the difficulty here is that in order to actually get the marginal amount of money that makes these banks make their money, they need to be more like the traditional banks, and they don't have that traction and don't have those revenue sources for lending, essentially, that those bigger traditional banks do. So what they've started doing is increasingly thinking about other more, I don't know, tech world focused ways of monetizing. And of course that eventually means selling your data, right? It means analyzing and selling your data. And it's kind of interesting to see like the incentives have played out that way, right? That they came into it being like, we'll do better user experience. That means that we'll take market share from the traditional banks, and then we can monetize like a traditional bank, right? We lend, we make a load of money, everybody's happy, you know. That's it. We saw a gap in the market. We took it. We killed an old dinosaur. But what's happened is that the incumbents have moved just quickly enough that they didn't fully die, and they've just taken their place back in the market, which has left the kind of innovators being too big to be bought out because they're worth a lot of money, too big to fail because they're all regulated and their deposits are backed, but too small to really grow much bigger other than expanding to other markets. And that's very expensive, and there's different regulation in different markets. It's just like really, again, back to the intermediation point, it's kind of, again, a fascinating thing with you're like, we don't know, they're just financial data and stuff. Anyway, but you know, I live in hope that we're only a couple of years away or a few years away from it being possible to do actual digital cash systems where you can, you know, pay with something like cash and not hand over all that data. That would be nice.
I've been kind of watching this, the same thing you're talking about, flow in different paths for two banks that I use, Brex and Mercury. Mercury, I guess, kind of went through the same path, and their choice for like how to monetize further is originally they were only for businesses, and now they've added in personal. Personal is like $200 a year, right? So really not that much, but they know that their clientele is like tech employees, right? And so they're like, $200 a year, like we'll definitely get our stuff paid off for that. And Brex has gotten the opposite in that it's offboarding people. Like we have money in Brex, but they're like, you're not using it enough, so we're just going to start kicking people out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they're not making enough of it.
Yeah, exactly. So
why are they offboarding you? Because you don't have a big enough deposit in there, or?
And I'm not using it enough. Yeah. So I have deposit in there to kind of like split up my funds, my emergency funds. But it's not like actual utilization is high enough. Not that there's not enough deposit, the utilization isn't high enough. So
is that because they charge you every time you do a transfer or something?
They don't.
No.
So like in theory, it should just be totally fine. But maybe it is the data thing. They're not getting the data from me. So get out of here. So like I'm pulling all my assets and stuff from Brex. Yeah.
Well, Brex also, I don't think the banking themselves, they don't make any money out, but like we use Brex card for a bunch of things, right? So they take a percentage off of that, like, cause it's a MasterCard, but it's cleared out daily. So they make something off of that. They have like, now they're starting to do obviously invoice payments where they take a piece out of the invoice. So there's no money in banking. Like there's no money in banking. So now it's all these auxiliary services, either transactions or not, you know, not even wires, right? It's got to be the transaction based type things. So like I actually moved because I used to do all like own part of credit card and do like expense reports and all that kind of stuff in, but I don't do it anymore. Like we just do all corporate now. And that's helped because we push in so much through like those types of cards that even they get cleared out daily, there's still like a good amount of transactions associated with that. Right. And that's where they make their money, not just cash sitting in there. So I do what you do in Brex. It's somewhere else at a different bank. So I know I'm on a list, right? Because it's just sitting there. It's like there's an oh shit bank in case the other one shuts down, right? That there's an oh shit bank associated to it. And then like we'll see if I get the same thing because they're like, hey, you're not using all these different services that we use and that's where we make our money type of thing. It's crazy.
We have our oh shit fund in a bank. We have to pay a business.
A monthly fee for?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which isn't bad either. Like I actually wouldn't mind that. Because I know
it's very low. It's like $20 a month, something like that. It's a tiny amount. And I'm just like, well, then they're never going to kick us out if we just hand that over. We also have safe deposit boxes and things with them as well as a business, you know, for ledgers and all sorts of other stuff. So we're just like, okay, like we're throwing them reliably maybe $1,000 a year total.
Right.
Probably less. Safe deposit box, not that much money. But it's just okay.
But like Chase and stuff like that, like, I mean, if you're paying, you know, even if you have a checking account that's $20 a month, you're off that list, right? They don't care. They're making their $20. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I guess at that the scale they're working at, like $20.
That's enough.
Yeah, more than enough.
That's enough. Yeah. I don't even know what Brex makes off us in fees. I think it's the idea that they know that we're using the platform. So therefore, as we grow, they grow, I think is probably it, right? And they don't want squatters. They don't want accounts. Because I assume they probably look at the draw per account. So if accounts are just sitting there not doing anything, they probably look at it and say, hey, look, you know, this is not worth it. Yeah.
So what's interesting is that one of the challenger banks, which I think has expanded to the US now, which is called Monzo, we have a business account with them.
Monzo.
But the for the personal accounts, which they do offer, to kind of what we were talking about earlier about like other ways of monetizing, they have a thing you can opt into now where it's like cashback, you know, cashback rewards with a lot of banks or credit cards. But they sell your data. They explicitly go like, here's the deal. You'll get cashback in a bunch of situations. We'll sell your data. And you know, you look at it.
I thought that was illegal in the EU.
You have to opt into it. You have to specifically opt in and you can specifically opt out at any time and you can request deletion. So it's all covered within GDPR. But I looked at it, did like some kind of back of the packet maths on like, yeah, the kind of shit we expense on the company card, which ain't lots. And the kind of stuff that I would expense if I did it for a personal account. And I was just like, I don't see how this ends up. But you know, I guess I've never really used a credit card with cash back. So I don't know. I don't have a frame of reference for, I've never had a credit card either. So,
Jesus fucking boomer.
I don't believe in it. I don't believe in debt. I believe in certain types of debt, but I don't believe in debt to a financial institution, where possible. So, you know.
So the reason why I use credit cards is mostly because if I use a credit card and like it gets skimmed, which happens way more than it should, with a credit card, I just say no. And the bank goes, okay, well, I guess I'll just reverse that and then I'll send you a new card. Or a debit card.
You have chip and PIN, right?
Yes. We have chip, PIN? No.
Not PIN.
For debit, yes. Chip and PIN for debit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you get card skin, they still don't have your PIN number. So
for debit, right? For credit, yeah. It's just basically, I mean, even chip, they're not going to skim it. Right. Unless, well, that's not entirely true. Now it's tap, right? So tap, you're not going to really get a good, you're not going to get skimmed off of that. Right. But if you're sliding the card into a reader, then yes, it will pull it off. There's still a magnet strip on the back, right? It's not just a chip. So it'll just pull it right off the strip.
So here, what gradually happened was when chip and PIN came in 2008.
It's been a while. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And they basically after about 2011, they generally just I think didn't activate the strip anymore. Like it's physically there on a lot. I have to look actually. Is it even there? Ours I'm not is. Even sure. Like I know that if you get a strip on a card from a challenger bank like Monzo or whatever, the strip is deactivated.
Oh, that would be great. It's here. It's still. Yeah, it really should be chip only. Like maybe you know the transition times here are like fucking decades, right?
Well,
like,
yeah, I've had to use the stripe on mine in the last week.
Yeah, right? Chip doesn't
like,
work.
I got to go parking something that I have to. So that's why I use credit card for that protection, and that's the main reason.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure you do too. Like we paid off. We use cashback cards. We get paid off every month, so it's just kind of like free money, if quote unquote. If you don't count your data and your sales information and where you buy and where you shop and how often you shop, and if you don't count that, then
you're not getting that information anyway
about your life.
if you're using a debit card, there's no way they're not getting that anyway.
Oh yeah, sure they are.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean,
sure they are. Yeah,
they'd be doing with a debit card. It depends on the terms of service of your bank. Like a traditional high street bank. Think it would be less certain actually because of data protection rules because they'd have to get you to sign stuff.
In the EU in the US
well I'm not we're not in the EU anymore but we do have the rules grandfathered.
Okay fair,
free, fair. We have freedom still. Now we have freedom and it has as it turns out no economic value.
That's not true. I think there's some negative value there.
Yeah, okay,
that's definitely not positive. Yeah. What else from Consensus? It was good to see everybody away from the show. It was good. We saw a lot of folks actually. That was really nice.
Yeah. Sucked to not be there. I was kind of,
It was hot as shit. On most days we had two units. One of them didn't have any working air conditioning, which was fucking awesome.
Did you have as many mosquito bites as I do? I've got mosquito bites just absolutely everywhere.
They're fucking everywhere.
You just before the show that you were feeling unwell. Have you got malaria?
I have it could be. I have like a spider bite on my my fucking palm and shit. Like, I came back like bitten up. One night one night the three of us were like, we were hanging out late, right? We had like this fire on, which was like a stupid gas fire. Then we were burning these useless citronella candles. And then we're out there
you were burning like, some useless what?
Citronella candles, like trying to keep these mosquitoes away. And they were everywhere. Like they were all over the place. It was dark in there. We couldn't see anything. And then Schultz's like, I think I'm getting bit up. I'm like, I think I am too. And then we go inside. We're like, I'm just covered. This is fucking
mosquito. And they're the little mosquitoes. You couldn't even see them. Like in Oregon, at least they have the decency to be like this big. So you can go.
Right. Yeah. They were like at my elbows and everything else. So we saw like a lot of teams. We saw the SATA team was there. Peter's in chat right now. It's good to see you, Peter. And we saw, like I said before, from like traditional Cosmos teams, like Jack was down there and Shane and Ethan. And like, there's a lot of good, Allura team we met, SATA team we met. Sorry?
Buckman.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
I really appreciate talking to Jay from Say. I think that was Jay one of my highlights. Because I haven't actually met the Say team in person. And not Jay specifically. I haven't really talked to them. Phil, I talked with fairly regularly, maybe every few days. Yeah. But Jay, I've never really interacted with too much.
And neither,
Getting to talk to him and getting to know him a bit, that was good.
That was really cool, yeah. It was great, and like it was nice to be able to see different teams and like put them together. Like, do you guys know each other? Like that type of thing. That was really fun. That was really cool. Then obviously we saw Bosco from Silk Nodes was there. Obviously Schultze and Null flew in, which is the reason he's not here tonight, because I left him Saturday morning. He was there for a couple more days, right? He flew Monday, I think. Monday US time. I think he landed this morning, Thursday morning Australian time. And so like he was dragging ass, like just for, this is a long day.
I can't believe he did it for such a short time as well. He must have been jet lagged
a week
the entire time.
No, I actually did pretty well. I think coming this way, it's a little bit better. Because you just he just stayed up, you know what I mean?
So
it's
a really
long day.
Coming back home from the US is always easier than going out, for sure.
Right. Yeah. So he's going. So basically, so it's a little bit rougher going the other way.
Whenever I go to the West Coast, I'm always just so fucked. I can't do anything, and then it's like, oh, it's time to come home, and I'm like, what the fuck? I've only just got over the jet lag, and then you just like I once came back from the West Coast and I went into work that morning. Like I did a red eye back from the West Coast of the US. Got off the plane, got on a train, just literally went straight in. Like, cause I just had a carry on, just went, walked straight into the office.
Yeah.
Just like, get me fucking coffee. Let's go. And they're like, wait, haven't you just got back from holiday? I was like, yeah, like 2 hours ago. Let's go.
You gotta fight through it.
Yeah. They're like, we're not really sure we want you to touch production service today, actually. I'm like, let's go. It's fine. It's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine. I was partying with John Lee Hooker last night. It's totally cool. was that last time? I think actually that might have been the time where it was, yeah, there was a thing in that chapel that's in Oakland, and John Lee Hooker's grave is there. And I was stoned as fuck, and I was just leaning. I was leaning against this thing, and then I just like looked behind me, and it said John Lee Hooker. And I was like,
you're like, holy shit!
I was like, holy shit! Is that John Lee Hooker? And this guy like literally just walks past me. It was just like, how many John Lee Hookers are there? Kind of thing. Like, just keeps walking. And I was like, yes, it's John Lee Hooker, huh?
That's funny,
because it wasn't like a small, because they were like, you know, there were some like. Because it was like a big public mausoleum, I think. Yeah, they're a lot like these really small little cubby holes. I don't know what you call it.
Yeah, it's like a little, just a small building, right?
Yeah, for really small like little cubby holes for the little dogs, and then there were like big plaques for the big dogs. And this was like a big dog plaque. So I was like, whoever John Lee Hooker was, he was a big dog. And there's only one. There is only one John Lee Hooker who is the biggest dog out of the John Lee Hookers. And also a big dog among the general population.
Yeah.
I guess that must be the John Lee Hooker, or that random person lied to me. But you know,
he's like, yeah, that's him.
Yeah, that's him.
That's him.
It turns out it was toilet paper magnet, John Lee Hooker, inventor of the perforated rip strip. You know what I'm talking about? That was John Lee. That was what made him his money. I heard one of those the other day where it was like, like improbably insanely wealthy people. It was something like, you know how some fruit comes in a bag where the hole is just big enough that you can kind of get the tip of a finger in and then it just rips. But the way the material is weaved is like in a double interlocked hexagon. So the bag the fruit is in is actually really strong and light until you put a finger through and just bam, and you can just get your oranges out. Yeah.
What the fuck does that have to do with John Lee Hooker?
My point is like, so I made the joke about the toilet paper perforation.
Oh, okay. All right.
Being a zillionaire. And I'm like, oh.
I was picking up what you were putting down.
The other John Lee Hooker.
I was getting it.
Yeah.
Who created
the other John Lee Hooker. You know,
Jonathan Lee Hooker, who created the rippable orange bag.
Toilet paper strip, the rippable orange bag. You know, he made a lot of rippable items and,
all right. So the question, any other follow-up items from consensus? Any other final thoughts before we move off this fucking topic?
I'll add one bug thought. I got woken up by a cockroach landing on my face in the middle of the night.
We did not have the most amazing Airbnb. I will say that.
So the thing is, right, in the run-up to consensus, there was like this, oh, we've got this sick Airbnb. It's going to be totally awesome. Was it just like that expectation reality picture where it's like a horse and the back half is really detailed and the front half is just like a kid's sketch?
I went after a place that was like really walkable to everything, which that place was. Like, we could walk up the 6th Street. There was coffee and liquor store nearby. That's the only two that I actually looked up. Outside of the two things I looked up, there was coffee and liquor store nearby. There was also nice restaurants.
There's a liquor store in the basement, Frank.
That's all I looked for.
This is why this place had been chosen. Oh, yeah, and the venue's around the corner. Oh, okay, right, yeah.
And the venue was around the corner. We walked from the venue back to the house many times. And that was really nice because I feel at East Denver, like half the time I'm in a freaking Uber. Like everything is 20 minutes away and you got to like plan out because these two events are, oh shit, we're going to sit in a car for 25 minutes, right? And it's just exhausting. And so to be able to walk back and forth, that was really nice. Like, if you walk from the venue to the house in like 15 minutes, like if you hauled ass, that was cool. So the only issue with that is every one of those houses in that area are either like, they're lifers. Like, they've been there forever and the houses are really run down and they're just beat up and the house is worth nothing, but the lot's worth like $1 million. Or they converted them into like VRBO Airbnbs, and they're run by organizations, not people, right? They're run by companies who buying $1-2 million places and turning them into place, and they put no money into them. And so this place was for sale, which I didn't look at Zillow. Sometimes I do look at see if the rental is also for sale. That's usually a red flag. That means they're not putting any money into it. And this place, they haven't put any money into it. Like, they probably did it like maybe 5 years ago. Air conditioners were kind of shitty. The outside was kind of beat up. Like, it wasn't awful, right? But there wasn't really like it wasn't amazing. And then the AC units and one of the units was totally broken. I've been arguing with him, trying to get a refund and stuff, which was really disappointing because like John and like a couple other guys from Artifact couldn't stick around because it was miserable. Like, it just didn't work. So that was – it's kind of – it's like a trade-off between those two things. So next time we'll – I think – I wasn't really – I looked at it for like a day. Like I threw some options out, and the place looked fine, and it wasn't.
Next time you need to throw bull market validator dollars around.
It was still fucking expensive. Don't get me wrong.
It was still expensive.
Yeah, it was still expensive. Like it's – I think we – I don't know what it was, like grand a night or something like that. But across six of us isn't awful, but – But it was still like, I don't know. I think you're right. I think should have looked harder, and we should have like found a place that was, maybe we could have given up on the location and try to find something else. Cause the location was kind of what I was driving off of. So next time we'll find something else.
Yeah. Welcome to Game of Knows, the short term let.
That's right.
Podcast.
That's right.
I just realized that I did the shtick at the top of the show, and at no point did I then actually correct and say, welcome to Game of Nodes. This is how you can tell I've not done the podcast in 2 weeks.
Oh, wait, maybe you didn't.
No, yeah. I didn't. So,
all right. You want to do some news?
Let's do some news.
Any news to do?
Everybody's going to crack their knuckles, adjust, you know, get the necks all loose. Yeah, would say this sloth thing, we all missed that. Unless you – did you guys get on the ground floor? Of the sloths?
No.
I'm not a sloth holder. Nope.
They're on TIA tier, Celestia, which is
what they're on Celestia. Yeah. Yep.
That's why
they are selling pretty well on Stargaze. I was actually just looking. It actually is bouncing back because before it was higher than this before. It was like, I think right now the floor price is $4,000. It's 5,000, just like, yeah, like basically 4,900, 4,950.
Do you ever see the film Blood Diamond?
Yes.
I am going somewhere with this. So, you know, like he keeps saying, like Leonardo DiCaprio's character keeps saying, this is Africa. He keeps saying DIA. Whenever something happens, like he keeps saying to the I can't even remember, the journalist. She's a journalist, isn't she? Whenever he tries to explain something really fucked up, he's just like, oh, DIA. And every time I see Tia's in the Celestia ticker, in my head, it pauses in Leonardo DiCaprio's South African accent from the film Blood Diamond. I just hear DIA. And I can't take that token seriously. And I'm just like, people keep making money off it. And I'm just like,
that's a sick reference.
This is how broken I am as a person. I look at a thing and I'm like, because it faintly reminds me of a one-liner from a 15-year-old movie, I cannot get involved in this project, and I will not get involved in this project.
There's been some pretty big sales recently. A couple outliers at $8,000 and $9,000, but there is a pretty good. Yeah, there's a lot of fixed price offers. People are buying. Last sold was around $5,000. There's been one around 5,500, things like that. So floor price is high. Yeah, there's been some pretty high rarity ones sold too.
What's the floor price on a bad kit these days?
I think it is about. Let me take a look at it real quick.
Because if the floor on a sloth is higher than the floor on a bad kit, then
oh, it definitely is. Yeah, floor price on bad kits right now is $1,800. So it's about 40%
of that. Why are sloths so popular?
I mean, yeah. There's also 2,500 of them versus 10,000 bad kids.
If we did an NFT collection of tulips, do you reckon it would take off?
As long as we like spell it weird or I don't know.
Like, okay, so
do they have sunglasses?
But my perspective here is that like
I've been a hat.
I've been working on some stuff recently, and I've been reflecting on the fact that in my whatever we're on now, 4 years in crypto, something like that, every time I've had a clever idea, I've worked on it for a long period of time and made no money off it. Every time I've had a dumb idea, the dumbest things I've done have been the most profitable. The things that I've done that have taken literally the least effort have tended to be the most profitable.
Except for Game of Nodes.
Game of Nodes, profitable.
That's low dumb. That's high dumb, low revenue.
No, because we've got business off of Game of Nodes. Game of Nodes is one of the few activities that has definitively paid for itself, actually.
That's true.
Actually, on a variety of axes, Game of Nodes has paid for itself because... But anyway, I digress. The point is that I'm not thinking dumb enough. And so I'm just like, okay, what if NFT collection of tulips? There we are. Bam. Little meta joke. And then we move on, right? Just make some money. Yeah. Rug pull collection.
And Mad Scientist was the other one that was on Osmosis, I think. It was minted on Osmosis, I think. I've been watching that too. It's kind of flattening out, but I thought so. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Robert's going to correct me. I thought this was the first cross chain NFT mint of some sort. I don't know. Now I feel dumb. Something like that.
I feel dumb all the time.
Yeah.
Ooh, here's a news item. I've heard that Mars is going to spin down its validator set and become a smart contract on Neutron.
I did hear about that. Yeah. How about that?
The question is,
go ahead.
Will it do that before we deactivate our Mars validator, which we've had on the pending pile since March?
You know, you don't care very much when you won't even deactivate it. Like,
it involves getting a ledger out of a bank vault.
So not an ICF chain, a smart contract on an ICF chain.
Yeah. I mean, I mean this totally not facetiously. I think that's courage. That's capital C courage. That's like... We should do the same for Chihuahua, except that should just go to DAO and a dozen other chains. I'm a huge fan.
I mean,
why not Osmosis, though? I think that's the more interesting reason, because Mars originally, if I remember correctly, was supposed to only be deployed on Osmosis, right? Like that was their main satellite. Yeah. And the fact that they're not choosing Osmosis for that, I think is utterly fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, what the fuck is Mars at this point? Like,
that's a great question. The funny part too is that Mars was intended to just be like a dead chain with a smart contract that Mars was put into, right? So why did they do a chain originally in the first place, aside from hopefully
getting trying to make some money because they got rugged by the Terra crash.
Yeah.
And the end result of that is that it's been a wildly unprofitable project to be a part of. Dead chain from the start, so
I remember this coming up a while ago. Actually, I had to go look. So this was back in November, right? Did they approve it? Is it happening?
I don't. What was approved? Mars
like
being
did they down? Did they put it? Like, was it like a governance structure that they were going to make a decision associated with this, or what were they doing?
So I've only read a tweet so far. Okay. That was like the plan for how it's going to unravel from the team. I don't know that there's been a governance thing yet.
Okay. Yeah, I did see that in the. It was like back last year. I remember, but this is. Proposed migrating mission control to Neutron, which I thought kind of meant moving it all, but maybe it doesn't. I'll put a link to the show notes in that. Yeah. I mean, we always joke about half these chains to be smart contracts. And so this one is showing that that's accurate.
Yeah. I mean, we could go further and say that half of these chains could be smart contracts and half of these smart contracts could be not existing. And they actually wouldn't have any less value because all of it is completely imaginary along with their use case. And
once again, I would say there'd be more value in having never existed because so much money has gone into like server costs and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think the real IQ 9000 play is it's back to War Games 1985. What a curious game. The only way to win is not to play.
Rama says Delphi Digital invested in Neutron, Astroport, and Mars, which makes sense. That's why they would obviously move that towards Neutron.
Yes, follow the original statement of follow the money.
That's right. Well, Mars was far before Neutron, right? So now I guess, that original goal of that launch and now where that should be. I guess that totally makes sense now.
So we have a couple other news items. There's that Texas Stock Exchange thing is kind of funny. Is it Which meaningful one? At all? This news item, BlackRock and Citadel team up and raise $120 million. Doesn't seem like a lot of money, just in my opinion, to create a new Texas Stock Exchange and plans to take on the two big New York stock exchanges. The plan is to be pro-crypto and list the current BTC and ETFs, among others, they're looking to get approval for. This reminds me a little bit. So recently, in golf, the Saudis started an alternate golf league and basically bought the whole thing. Recently, they tried to do the same to pro cycling, and they were like, we have got $240 million and we are going to start a new cycling league. And then anybody who knows anything about cycling goes, okay, Ineos Grenadiers, granted, the biggest budget in cycling, 50 million euro per year. There are 18 World Tour teams, granted, not with the same budgets, but $240 million, that's like 180 million euros. Well, you're going to have four teams. What are they going to do, race around in the desert? And bear in mind that if you compete in an alternative league that's not approved by the UCI, you don't ride the Tour de France, which is like the third most viewed sporting event in the world and the only one that matters to every single World Tour team. In fact, they have to ride it, otherwise they lose their license. So what are you going to do?
Really? I didn't know that.
Fuck you. It's the third most watched sporting event in the world.
Something like that, yeah. It's like,
get the hell out of here.
The viewership of the Tour de France globally is really big, like bigger than you would expect.
You mean within 500 miles of France?
No.
Globally? I don't think Asia gives a shit. South America doesn't give a shit. I know the U.S. doesn't give a shit.
I think, what? Like this, Central American climbers.
You're wrong.
After Lance, it's number two.
It's decisively number two. Yeah.
Really?
2023, World Cup of Soccer was number one. Number two was Tour de France with 2.5 billion.
Third will be the
number three. Now, this is the surprising one. Cricket.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't.
No, that's not surprising. India, man.
Yeah, that's not surprising, actually. IPL.
Holy shit. Like,
I mean, the World Cup
is 5 billion people, though.
Oh, World Cup is totally easy.
The IPL was above the Tour de France. I would have guessed the IPL was above. No, the Tour de France is massive. I think it's huge. It is a massive, massive sporting event.
I know it's, I believe that. I just didn't think it was number two in that list. I would think it would be like top 10, but
yeah,
that seems insane.
Yeah. But anyway, the point is that not only is it a big deal if you are in cycling, you've got to do it, but also to be a World Tour team, which is a relegation system like any league, you have to ride the races in the World Tour, one of them being, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so when somebody turns up and they goes, we've got $240 million, we're going to buy this sport, you have to raise some eyebrows. This reminds me of that. We've got $120 million and we're going to rival the New York Stock Exchange. It's like, yeah, you've got $240 million. You want to rival the Tour de France. Good luck with that. We'll see you never. And this is like, yeah, okay, you want to rival the New York Stock Exchange by listing a Bitcoin ETF with $120 million? That's your war chest?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. There's the Chicago Stock Exchange, I think. But the whole think is kind of the point, right? Like, they've been around, I think, longer than the New York Stock Exchange, but nobody uses it. Hey. So good luck.
Yusuf is like, hey, we're Rhinos listed on the Rhinos list on the Chicago Stock Exchange.
It's pretty popular.
This feels like one of those, like, if we announce a thing and put an imaginary number on it, we can get a headline, and then we might not even ever actually have to do the thing because people will have forgotten about it pretty quickly. That's
my guess. Is watching the Tour de France.
All right, I gotta retract this. I was decisively wrong. The New York Stock Exchange is 100 years older than the Chicago Stock Exchange.
Okay.
So
that's actually quite a big gap.
It's a big gap. Yeah. It's a big gap. But the Chicago Stock Exchange has been around since the late 1800s.
Respectable period of time.
First 100 years is only trading like pierogies and fucking hot dogs and shit. So we got those other stocks in there. All commodities.
was about to say.
Paluski and
What do you reckon is the oldest stock exchange in the world? Probably there's probably one in the Netherlands, right?
That's what I was going to say.
There's some lovely filth over here.
I think it's funny.
That's a good reference. It's a deep cut. It's a deep cut. Like, so, some watery bent distributing swords. There's no basis for a system of government. Which actually, to be fair, this is the current state of what is happening in the UK. election fever. It all fell apart pretty quickly for it's just it's been funny.
Women's World Cup is number 4. This list doesn't make any sense to me. Schultz, I think we're looking at the same ones. Football, summer games.
Football is very popular.
Women's World Cup on
Americans don't summer understand. Games. Football is very popular. People will watch any football.
Well, I think the question is around the women's part of it because, like,
I mean, that's
in the U.S. I've so, like, the Timbers Army in Portland, their soccer game, the soccer league, is really popular. Timbers Army always sells out. The Thorns, which is the women's side, is frequently empty. Like, very few viewers.
So I think what started to happen, I don't know if this is in every country. I imagine it's very, very different in different places. But I think what's happened is advertisers have worked out that if you can sell women's soccer, or football, as we call it in the rest of the world, and then it gets popular, you can then advertising reach like half the population. Who knew? And it turns out women weren't watching football because they don't understand it. It's because they just don't give a shit about their partners complaining about 10 blokes running around a pitch, and they're just like, I just don't want to get into it. Whereas if they can just watch something without their partner talking over them all the time, they're kind of into it. So I don't know. It kind of feels like the money is going into women's soccer, and that's why it's growing. Same as women's cycling. Like, that's been like exponentially growing the last few years, and it's like a pretty similar story where it's professionalizing pretty fast. So
I guess my surprise comes from there was this big news thing or event semi-recently, where a woman that was in pro basketball, I want to say, when in the offseason, she would go play sports in Russia because Russia paid more than U.S. did. And this is significant because she then was imprisoned and was like part of a like an exchange of prisoners. Whoa. So like, because she got paid so little, she would then go work in Russia as a professional sports player. So
that's pretty wild.
Yeah.
So like in the chat, Rama says, Australian women's team got 80K watching a friendly versus China 2 nights ago. That's in Australia. So that's how big women's soccer is becoming. I'm guessing that is football.
I think it's great.
That must be football, not Aussie rules football, right, Rama? Because I'm guessing they don't play Aussie rules football in China. Have you ever seen Aussie rules football? It's wild.
Yeah. Yeah, the footy. I've been to a couple of footy games actually.
I've been like,
oh, really?
Melbourne.
It's so. Oh yeah, I've been in Melbourne
it's
as well.
Fun. I went to the same. Like, dude, we had a great time.
I had literally no idea what to expect of the sport, and then I was like, I got to the thing. Like, bear in mind, I'd gone in completely cold. I'm not a sports guy really, other than cycling and a couple of other things. Watching a bit of climbing. Olympic bouldering is the coolest sport, hands down. It is like watching Spider-Man.
They basically do like flips up the wall, and you're like, what is happening?
Oh my god, have you ever watched lead climbing, competitive lead climbing? So they're doing it like really fast, like boom boom, like, or like professional ice climbing. It's genuinely like watching a scene from an action film. Like
that I haven't seen, but it sounds awesome.
Like, have you seen the one where, the one where they do it with like, where it's lead climbing, but they also do like ice. So they have crampons, and they sometimes will suspend like on chains, like a block of ice or a block of simulated ice in between two of the, what do they call them? What do they call a climbing challenge? They call it, they have a word.
I have no idea.
Yeah, I have no idea either.
It's not problem, but they have a word for like a thing that needs solving, and they'll have like two walls and then like a chunk just suspended in the air, and then they would be like, well, there's nothing for it. They just like leap. You're just like, whoa, what the fuck is this? This is insane. It's like an action film. But yeah, climbing is sick, isn't it? But yeah, no, I just walked into the arena and was like, why is the pitch oval shaped? This isn't cricket. And then they get the ball and then they start running with it in their hands. And you're like, wait, this isn't rugby. You're just like, this is all wrong. This is all the sports back to front. I don't understand. I guess you guys know what rugby is, right? It's basically like American football, yeah. but not.
I played collegiate rugby. Yeah.
Okay. Do you know how it got invented?
I don't.
It got invented in rugby, obviously. And I think I want to say he was a private school boy. Let's say that. Why not? Some guy called Ellis. I say Ellis Webb. Might have that a little bit wrong. Just picked up the ball in a game where you weren't allowed to pick up the ball, and he ran with it. And they were like, boys will be boys, and a new sport was born out of male privilege. There you go, rugby. That's literally.
And now you have hookers. Like, that's an important distinction to rugby.
Yeah,
I was the hooker in my team.
I didn't have the build for a hooker. I was a winger. You can tell I'm a lank. I was a wing. I have no strength. So, a friend of mine was front row, like a prop, and he was so good. I once saw him tackle somebody and then adjust in midair to tackle somebody else using the body weight of the person he had just knocked to the ground. That person popped past and he just adjusted off of them, took out the other guy.
We had someone that played on our team who, like, all of us were like 210 pounds or so. So I was like 40 pounds more than I am now. This guy was 300 pounds of muscle, I swear to God. And he was like 6'8". So he would come running past and he would just throw people out of the way, because with a 100-pound difference, and he was like pure muscle. So like when you went down and guard the ball, when he wanted you to move, he would just pick you up, throw you, and then go running. Like, you just, there's nothing you could do about it. It was outrageous. He was like the nicest guy. His name was Brian. Oh man, the nicest guy.
I imagine it's kind of like a lot more fun doing rugby when you're sort of voluntarily doing it in that kind of situation. When you have to do it at school, it's literally like the equivalent of that is the fat kid in the year who's also the bully, or is like, or is maybe not even the bully. He's just a piece of shit. And he's just like, this is just a chance to rake everybody and just like run into you, knock you over because he's so fucking heavy compared to you, and then just rake you with his boots. And you're like,
Okay. Yeah. No, this was a rugby club. And so like we were all volunteering for it. And because he was so nice, like the way he would hit you, you would go down, but you wouldn't go sprawling. Like he had so much skill and he was such a great team captain.
I did it at university and I was in the smallest hall of residence at my university. So it was we had 200 people, right? So university of, I think 40,000 undergraduates, our hall was 200 people, right? Obviously, mixed gender as well. So in the, to field a men's team, we had plausibly, I think probably about 80 blokes, to make up 11 every Sunday plus a couple of injuries, right? So realistically you need 15 to 20 people to even practice. So it was a case of there were two lads who had played under 18s and under 21s and were really good, and two people who were moderately good who had done under 18s, like, for these guys were county level, right? So they were really good, and then everybody else was just like drafted in all shapes and sizes. And then to cover injuries and people being away and whatnot, there were a couple of people who were just in as the subs. And one of them was, he was about 5'2". He had played a bit in school, private school in Hong Kong. He was 5'2", probably about 60 kilos. I don't know what that is in pounds, about 100 pounds. No, about 130 pounds, something like that. Yeah. Something 130.
Yeah, pounds. I'd go, I think it's 130.
Yeah. Quite a small guy. Right. And, so the biggest hall of residence at the university is over 8,000, right? And they just fully fielded a team of people who'd only played at town or county level before they came to university. They were all just tanked, actual rugby players, taking it seriously. They all played for the athletic union, like the varsity team, whatever, the university teams. And it's just like us all hungover on a Sunday morning, like, just like, okay, we are going to get completely wrecked. And like the other teams were dead sound about it. They were just like, like, we'll try, you know, all right, boys, good job for turning up. Like, you know, we'll keep it a clean game. We'll keep it a clean game. And then you would just get pounded into the ground every, like, the second you got the ball, whap. We scored 3 points in the entire season. And it was in the first minute of the first game. And it's because one of the two lads who was really good got past it, immediately kicked for the points. And they were just like, oh, that was good. And then
that didn't sound fun at all.
We got so destroyed that first game that after that, he was like, there's no point kicking. There's no point kicking. We can only score tries. And then we didn't score any in the entire season. Oh, it was a shambles. But anyway, the point was that that kid from Hong Kong, who was really game, like absolute lad, champ, he got run over by a guy that must have been 120 kilos of muscle. And he had to... He finished the match, went back to our hall, had a shower, came out for the curry afterwards. And then at the curry, about halfway through, he was just like, I'm sorry, boys, I'm just in a lot of pain. And there are some medics, it was first year, so none of the junior doctors knew fucking shit. They were just like, what kind of pain? And he was like, described it. And they were like, you need to go to hospital. And so our hall of residence was like 800 meters from the A&E of the hospital in the city. So he just like was like, see you boys later, got up from the table, walked to hospital, and did not come home that night. I think he fractured his collarbone.
Jeez.
And he'd just gone to the pub afterwards, had some pints with the boys, and gone for a curry. What a legend. Anyway, game of legends.
Game of legends.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, film recommendation. Have you seen Civil War?
Like, what Civil War? Like Marvel Civil War?
Captain America Civil War? The Alex Garland film.
That's new, right?
Yeah, I watched it on your Plex server, you surfer, so.
Don't get around to that too much.
Yeah. It's really good.
I did watch something on a recommendation. What did I watch? It was 2 weeks ago already. I can't remember what the hell we were watching.
I watched something.
No, on Game of Notes we were talking about
Thunder.
What were we just talking about? Brick.
Oh yeah, Brick.
Yeah, Brick. We were talking about. Yeah.
Brick. Yeah. Did you watch Brick?
I did watch Brick. I couldn't tell you what it's about because it was 2 weeks ago. But yeah, I did. JGL was pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like surprisingly good.
Surprisingly good, right?
That was a good movie. It was a little bit fucked up. I can see why you like it.
Wasn't it?
It was a little bit fucked up.
That film.
I'm like, what kind of fucking high school is this?
Yeah, I know, right? There's a lot.
Like, nobody gives a shit. Yeah, like that chick got murdered. Anyway. You going to class? You going to class? Like, you got my notes?
Yeah, should we just keep on being kind of vaguely depressed and taking drugs? Yeah, why not?
Exactly. Whatever. Exactly.
It's
totally what it was.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a good. I would recommend that. Not to everybody, but yeah, I would recommend that. So Civil War, is that what I'm watching next?
Yeah. It's the trailer is like, this is a war film. It's boom, daka, 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 boom, boom, boom. And then the actual film is basically about some journalists in a war zone.
Oh, okay.
And that's
it. It looks pretty good. I'm looking up right now.
It's a dystopian future America.
Yeah,
isn't every film about that right now?
Don't look up all of the fucking, just watch the film. Like, there's lots of talk online. I just watch the film. It's very well paced, very well put together. It's one of the only films I can think of where I've watched it with my partner and she didn't go, that film was half an hour too long. We finished it and it was like Dune 2.
This one.
Like, yeah. She was the like, war. Yeah. That was about the right length. But crucially, like there's a scene in it. There's a scene in it, which I think is like maybe the modern equivalent of like, the Saving Private Ryan beach scene, maybe.
Uh-huh.
Like as in just like a masterpiece of like cinematography.
Really?
In a kind of war film context. Like it's just very, very cleanly done. Like just really gets across the idea and the energy there's a couple of shots in there which are just too good. They're almost too good because I noticed them. I was like, that is a great shot. That is the power of cinema right there. And then I was like, ah, damn, if it was just like, if is it better if you don't notice it, or if it's so amazing and eye grabbing that you're like, that's a fucking great shot. That is cinema. That is cinema. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. A film study student might be able to tell you, but yeah.
All right. You say so.
There's a great sequence anyway.
Oh, this last piece. You want to talk about this last piece before we get off?
The Jacob thing? The news headline or Jacob thing? Jacob thing. Take it away.
Yeah. So we'll link it in the show notes. But so Jacob Gedakian, I'm pronouncing that based on Schulze's pronunciation. I think that's correct.
Hold on. Nuh-uh. I pronounce it as Gedakian.
Oh, I was close. I actually thought I was getting it right. I'm sorry. So he released a document, which I guess the fair name for that is an affidavit, which is really just him, which is just a legal way of being able to put something on record, right? He's not really putting anything. I guess he's trying to have some sort of claim, but he doesn't know who he's claiming against. And in this doc, which we'll link to, because he put it out publicly, I wouldn't link to this otherwise. Like, so the only reason we're talking about it. But I guess it's of Notional. At some point over the last 6 months, maybe from October to February or so, he had diminishing of assets up to the value of $1.513 million USD. And that's, he has a list of what those assets were in terms of what was stolen or at least pilfered, I guess, through a couple different sexes that he had items hosted at. It looks like KuCoin, Exchange CX, I forget who else it was, and maybe in a couple wallets. I actually haven't reviewed it too much to see what was going on. But everything from Celestia to Say tokens to a bunch of bad kids, like 11 bad kids, a bunch of Stars, Atom, Osmosis. I think there was a bunch of stuff in here. Injective, I think. A bunch of things that were kind of pilfered out. So I guess the story here, he doesn't know who stole them. I think that's correct. And they, I think he tried to, I'm not sure exactly, but it looks like he tried to be able to do some deposits in some of these types of things and allow an investigation to be able to like continue to see where those things were pulled in. But yeah, so anyway, I guess we'll follow this up. I'll put a link into it. Maybe we could talk about a little bit more next week when we have a little bit more history on it. But this is, I think this was published just recently. This document is dated back in May, the 1st of May or 7th of May or something like that. And you know, I mean, honestly, I know we had some conversation about like team members of Notional leaving. And I think, Robert might've said something around, some wallet, mnemonics being in a shared one password account, meaning like a team password account where you might have multiple team members that might have access to that. I'm not sure if that's exactly correct, but if that was the case and depending on how those wallets were stolen or how some of those assets were pilfered, or even if they were stolen out of CX or out of sexes as well, or if there was just purely hot wallets. I mean, regardless, no, don't want to have anything stolen from anybody. And unauthorized transfers, regardless of what the history is not the right way of, if that was, I'm not sure if, where this history came from, but if that was obviously something that was a third actor that kind of worked towards us in some sort of way, that seems unlikely. The one password thing and like things where somebody had access to mnemonics, that would be obviously somebody on his former team, and that's clearly criminal. I mean, it's all criminal, right?
Yeah.
Then there's clearly better ways to be able to, if somebody feels jilted associated to lost revenue or from a back paid, you know, from maybe salary or other types of things, it's clearly not the way to resolve it. So anything where you have this much exiting an individual is not great.
I don't take too much issue with using 1Password to share hot wallets because, I mean, to a certain extent, you have to, right? Like, because we run relayers and oracles and stuff, like, the team needs access to these wallets, but these are considered, like, petty cash, right? Yeah. I have probably $3,000 or $4,000 floating on the relayer wallet any given day because we burn through that every month, right?
Right.
Where there's actual value in the wallets, those are going straight to, like,
Yeah,
like,
we
validator all keys on the shit. Ledger. Well, it's right? Like,
it's like if you have a company bank account, you might issue people who need to make payments like a debit card or something, or a credit card with a low limit. Like, but you don't make them an authorized co-signer of checks to max to unlimited value, do you? Like, it's basic financial OPSEC, like in a, you know, a boomer TradFi, a boomer way, like, you know, literally don't give them a checkbook or whatever. It's mad to give them the total balance of the entire company. I mean,
again, nothing against this situation because theft is theft, but this is not the best key management.
No.
Like, if that's actually what happened. And like, we use hardware keys for a bunch of shit, including, like, you know, sex removals and things like that, where we have backups at something physical to be able to prevent things like this. Like, no fun should leave a sex without something physical as well as a token and all that kind of shit. Yep. And that's what we, right? We do all that, especially when it gets in that situation. And even like on ledgers, you know, like that type of idea of, like, to your point, like, I do the same thing with like testnet accounts. Like, we rotate keys like fucking crazy. So not rotate, but we use different keys for every single chain and every single wallet. So yeah, having testnet like tough in there, I don't really care about that. Right. Like, I don't really care because it's just convenient, but you're right. Like, we vault all that shit. And like, once that's in that point, and those things should not be, there's no reason for team members to be able to share validator keys or be able to share other types of things that